Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, November 12th. We'll begin today with Congressman Richie Torres from the Bronx at this weird transitional moment in national politics. Democrats got wiped in the elections more than they hoped and are debating how to keep Congress in next year's midterms. The president just declared inflation a top priority for the first time. House Republican leaders are not denouncing Republican Congressman Paul Gosar, who released an animated video showing him stabbing President Biden and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but they are denouncing Republicans in Congress who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. That infrastructure bill could bring not just new construction, but revisiting the harms of old construction, like the Cross Bronx Expressway, in Congressman Torres's district. And it passed without being tied to the president's Build Back Better plan for child care, elder care, universal pre-K, a few weeks of paid family leave, and more that Torres and other House progressives wanted in the bargain. What the Democrats know is that they're on their own on that one. Here's Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert of Colorado on paid family leave.
I'm a mother of four. I delivered one of my children in the front seat of my truck because as a mom of four, we got things to do. Ain't nobody got time for 2.5 months of maternity leave. We have a world to save here.
Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert of Colorado. Her Republican colleagues may not all put it that way, but they've announced their intention to vote that way. With us now is Congressman Richie Torres, Democrat from New York's 15th Congressional District in the Bronx, covering the neighborhoods of, are you ready, in alphabetical order from his website, Bathgate, Belmont, Claremont, Clawson Point, East Tremont, Fordham, Harding Park, Highbridge, Hunts Point, Little Italy, that's the Bronx's Little Italy, Arthur Avenue and around there, Longwood, Melrose, Morrisania, Morris Heights, Mott Haven, Soundview, Tremont, Unionport, and West Farms, 10460. Congressman, we always appreciate when you come on. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's an honor to be here.
Unionport? Really? That's a neighborhood in the Bronx?
I just simply refer to it all as the South Bronx. Much simpler.
Go. All right. Want to react to that Lauren Boebert clip?
Well, Lauren Boebert is not a moral authority on anything, much less on paid family leave. But look, we fully expect to pass the Build Back Better Act on purely Democratic votes. You know, we take the position that infrastructure is about more than physical infrastructure, more than roads and bridges, but it should be about human and social infrastructure. And if we pass the Build Back Better Act, senior citizens will have access to home care, which is critical. We will lift millions of children out of poverty with an expanded child tax credit. And every three-year-old and four-year-old would have access to pre-K throughout the country. So these are transformational investments that would benefit the most vulnerable in our society.
You're in the House Progressive Caucus. Two of the other members who represent the Bronx, AOC and Jamal Bowman, voted no on the infrastructure bill because it got untethered from the Build Back Better human infrastructure bill. Why did you vote yes?
Well, the bipartisan infrastructure investment is historic in more ways than one. It's the largest investment in passenger rail since the creation of Amtrak, the largest investment in roads and bridges since the creation of the interstate highway system, the largest investment in clean energy transmission and electrification, both of which is critical to combating climate change, largest investment in clean water, which has implications for lead safety. It represents $1 trillion in funding for roads and bridges, waterways and highways, ports and airports, transit and rail, clean energy, clean water, broadband expansion. The bipartisan infrastructure framework is far from perfect, but it will do an enormous amount of good for an enormous number of people. And New York State alone could receive up to $170 billion in funding.
And in fairness, to you, there's like 90 members of the House Progressive Caucus. All but six voted for the infrastructure bill. But was that a defensive measure on your part after the election losses for the Democrats in Virginia and on Long Island and elsewhere to get at least the infrastructure bill through, but taking the risk that Build Back Better will fail because you untethered it?
Well, it was untethered before the vote. The Progressive Caucus had agreed to move forward with the bipartisan infrastructure framework based on the president's promise that he could deliver Manchin. But there was no guarantee that Manchin would in fact vote for the bill, right? The original progressive position was we would only wait for a vote in the Senate before voting on BIF. And the Progressive Caucus made a concession there. You know, I have to be honest, the notion that delaying BIF, the bipartisan infrastructure investment, would give us leverage when it comes to the Build Back Better Act is dubious. There's no evidence that Manchin cares about the bipartisan infrastructure investment. Like, he would be more than happy to see none of these bills pass. The only infrastructure that he cares about is coal in West Virginia.
So why was it tethered in the first place by the Progressive Caucus? It used to be your position. You said so on this show. There was a time when you were thinking of voting no on infrastructure because it wasn't tethered to Build Back Better.
I think no one anticipated the level of obstructionism that we've had to face from Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. You know, I've said that we no longer live in a democracy. We live under the tyranny of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And it's been a greater obstacle than most of us originally thought it would be.
Congressman Torres, we talked this week on the show about using some of that infrastructure money, as you've been hoping for reducing the harm from some Robert Moses era infrastructure, like the Cross Bronx Expressway that runs through your district. Can you tell us what you have in mind or what you can promise at this point?
Yes. Yeah, so as you know, in the South Bronx, there are about 15,000 truck trips to and from the Hunts Point Terminal Market. Right, there are thousands of trucks that create congestion on the Cross Bronx every day. And children who live near the Cross Bronx or who attend school near the Cross Bronx are, through no fault of their own, breathing in pollutants that cause respiratory diseases like asthma. You know, the prevalence of asthma in the South Bronx is not an accident. That is a consequence of the Cross Bronx Expressway. And so I've been on a mission to secure funding for the capping of the Cross Bronx Expressway. We've earned a new supporter in that cause, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Both Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and I have spoken to Secretary Buttigieg, and we're confident that we're going to secure what is known as RAISE grant funding for a feasibility study. And then once a feasibility study is complete, then a subset of those infrastructure dollars could potentially go toward capping the Cross Bronx. So it's far from mission accomplished, but we're making progress. You know, as we have the support of the future mayor, Eric Adams, the support of the majority leader. I've spoken to Secretary Buttigieg directly. And as you know, he brought up the name of Robert Moses. Mm-hmm. And for me, the Cross Bronx Expressway, which was built by Robert Moses, is both literally and metaphorically a structure of racism. You know, William Faulkner once said that the past is not dead, it's not even past. And we in the Bronx continue to be haunted by the ghost of Robert Moses.
You know, some people say we should just remove certain stretches of highway in some places, not just cap them like you're talking about for the Cross Bronx, like the Sheridan Expressway in the Bronx, that they're unredeemable from a public health and quality of life standpoint, and we should start dismantling the fossil fuels infrastructure anyway. Your thoughts about that?
What we're proposing is much more realistic, much simpler, much less disruptive solution. You know, capping a highway is much less expensive than digging it underground. The project, the Big Dig in Boston, like dragged on for decades, had billions of dollars in cost. I think the ultimate cost was $20 billion. The projected cost of capping the Cross Bronx is less than $1 billion. And again, this is not meant to be pursued in isolation. I think we are committed to electrifying vehicles. So the combination of electrification and capping the Cross Bronx would have a real impact in improving not only the environment, but the public health of the South Bronx.
How else do you foresee the infrastructure money benefiting your constituents or the city?
In several ways. I mean, one, in the United States, there have been, in 2020, there were 22 extreme weather events that cost the United States up to $100 billion. And New York City saw not only one, but two record rainfalls, which led to almost biblical levels of flooding. We saw residents drown in their own apartments. We saw strap hangers who were stranded in flooded subways. We saw motorists who had to be evacuated from the rooftop of their vehicles by emergency responders on lifeboats. So we have become ground zero for catastrophic climate change here in New York City. The bipartisan infrastructure investment will allocate about $500 million for climate resilience, coastal resilience, flooding resilience, which is desperately needed. It invests not only in traditional roads and bridges, but also public transit. The MTA alone will receive $10 billion, which will mean funding for subways and buses and rail. It will support the Second Avenue subway in Manhattan. It will support the siting of the four Metro North stations in the Bronx. Amtrak is set to receive $66 billion, and $24 billion of those dollars will go toward the Northeast Corridor, which will disproportionately benefit New York City. It will support the reconstruction of the Hudson River tunnels and the East River tunnels, which are said to be critical to the siting of the Metro North stations in the Bronx. So the benefit for New York City is outsized.
My guest is Congressman Richie Torres from the Bronx, Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Gerard in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Gerard.
Yes. Hey, Brian. I'm a big admirer of the congressman. My question is, was it evident from when you're in the freshman class of Cawthorne and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert, was it evident from meeting them right from the get-go that they were just in the cult of Trump, or is this something that's evolved since the Biden administration has come in and they just want to be obstructionist on everything? Or was there ever any hope that these people, you could work with them? And are there any Republican freshmen, I know Mr. Mayer voted for impeachment, and Ms. Mace from South Carolina. Are there any Republican freshman congresspeople who you can work with, or who on the side speak with you privately and you sense some hope that maybe after this period has gone that we can move forward on and get an bipartisan infrastructure deal where people who vote for it aren't being threatened? Is there some hope?
Gerard, thank you so much. Congressman?
Well, look, the Republican Party increasingly has become a cult of personality around Donald Trump. And we see Republicans deny the truth about the 2020 election. We've seen Republicans reject the peaceful transfer of power. Half of the Republican caucus voted to overturn the results of the Electoral College, which was an unprecedented assault on the peaceful transfer of power. You know, to oversimplify, there are two kinds of people who go to Washington, D.C. There are policymakers and performers. And it was clear to me from day one that Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Madison Cawthorn are performers, are interested in performative rather than substantive politics. There are Republicans who are constructive. You know, I've been able to partner with Congressman Katko and Congressman Garbarino on matters relating to cybersecurity. We've passed legislation together. I've partnered with
Katko,
Congressman
just
Meyer.
For context, Katko from upstate New York, Garbarino from Long Island. Go ahead.
Exactly right. Congressmember Peter Meyer from Michigan, who actually voted to impeach Donald Trump, I partnered with him on legislation relating to veteran housing. So I do have working relationships with Republicans who are serious about policymaking.
I guess that brings us to the news about Republican Congressman Paul Gosar, not a freshman. The animated video that a lot of people, if they haven't seen, they've heard about by now, doesn't just depict him attacking Biden and AOC with swords. It depicts AOC as a giant that little Paul Gosar is going after like he's David and she's Goliath. I mean, I'm seeing Michael Brown. I'm seeing Tamir Rice. I'm seeing, you know, scary dark people perceived by certain white people as bigger and more powerful than they are. Am I overreacting here?
If you would have asked me who is the single most despicable member of Congress, it would be Paul Gosar. I mean, here's a man who has done events with avowed white supremacists. He has not only incited, but he may have aided and abetted the insurrection against the U.S. Capitol. And now he's promoting images that incite violence against his colleagues. If that is not disqualifying, then I'm not sure what would be.
They say, I guess a lot of Republicans say, whether or not they agree with everything Paul Gosar has ever done or said, that it's just a cartoon. It's a symbolic political slaying, not permission for anyone to commit real violence. What's your reaction to that?
Again, if we turn a blind eye to his misconduct, then we become complicit, right? Congressmember Ocasio-Cortez is one of our highest profiled members. I suspect she's often the target of threats, and the kind of images that he is propagating will only serve to incite violence and put her life at risk. And that is unacceptable, and he should be held accountable.
I see that just a few weeks ago, before this anime, you called for Gosar and a few others to be expelled from Congress for their roles in January 6th. What do you believe Gosar did with respect to that?
No, only if there is a finding.
If there is a finding.
If there is a finding that those members of Congress not only engaged in inflammatory rhetoric, but aided and abetted, actively aided and abetted, a frontal assault on the Electoral College on January 6th, then that, in my opinion, is grounds for expulsion.
And that hasn't been determined yet, but do you think there's evidence indicating that might have happened?
There have been preliminary reports, but I would want to wait to see a final report from the January 6th commission or select committee.
And Jane in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane. Thanks for calling in.
Great. Good morning, everybody. I'm wondering if the congressman could comment about our own backyard. He talked about mansion and cinema. Great. But we in New York like to point fingers at other parts of the country and maybe sometimes ignore our own backyard, particularly with respect to the ballot proposals in New York State, which take a lot of effort to get on the ballot. Conservative Party put in apparently a ton of money to have the no votes prevail, and the Democratic Party apparently did not. And so things that would have enfranchised more of Congressman Torres's voters and helped with our districting, et cetera, did not pass. And I'm wondering if you can comment on this, because some people are calling for some big changes in the New York State Democratic Party.
Jane, thank you very much. And for people who don't know the background there, these two big voting rights ballot proposals that you would think would be no-brainers in blue New York, for permanent, no-excuse mail-in ballots like we've had during the pandemic, to make that permanent. You don't have to be out of state or something and ask for an absentee ballot. Anybody could do mail-in permanently. That lost in a statewide referendum last week. So did same-day voter registration. And Congressman, I think she characterizes correctly that the conservatives just put in more effort than the Democratic Party on that. What's your take?
I agree completely. It's inexplicable that the Democratic Party spent no money defending our own policy proposals. You know, we cannot trust that our policy initiatives are going to prevail on the merits. We have to campaign for them. We have to make the case for them. And we have to combat the disinformation campaigns that are likely to come from the right. So I agree with the critique completely.
Also about the election results, we talked on the show yesterday with Assemblyman Ron Kim from Queens about East Asian Americans, his district, which voted for him, another very progressive politician, voted for him, but voted in the main for Curtis Sliwa, according to the election results. And East Asian Americans in general in New York City voting majority Republican, according at least to exit polls and the data that people are parsing. What do you make of that, and what task does it give the Democratic Party?
I mean, I find it alarming. We saw a Republican surge in the vote in places like the East Bronx and in Southern Brooklyn, among the Asian population in Queens. And it should be a wake-up call for us as a party. And we cannot take any constituency or any neighborhood for granted. I do worry that the Republicans are making gains among Latinos, less so in New York City, but elsewhere in the country. We might have seen it in Virginia and New Jersey. We saw it in Texas and Florida in the 2020 presidential election. I worry that Republicans are now making gains among college-educated whites, exploiting issues like critical race theory. So, you know, for me, the best politics is effective governing. And if we govern effectively, then I'm hopeful that the politics will take care of itself. But we have to run on pocketbook issues. Like, there's no better issue on which to run than something like affordable prescription drugs. It commands almost 90% support from Democrats and Republicans. You know, there's a debate within the party.
And that's back in Build Back Better, as I understand it, right?
It is, yeah, it is. You know, there are those in the party who argue that we should focus on issues that are popular with swing voters who decide the outcome of elections. And then there are those who argue that we should focus on issues that galvanize the base, that turn out the vote. The truth is we can do both. There are issues like affordable prescription drugs that both galvanize the base and appeal to swing voters. And those are the issues on which we should run and win elections.
Congressman Richie Torres from the Bronx, we always appreciate when you come on. Thank you so much for today.
Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.